Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and you're listening to our coverage of the recent 200 Years of Dinosaurs conference at the Natural History Museum in London, to which we sent one of our new team members, Emily Keeble. Hi Emily, it's wonderful to have you join us on the team.
Hello, happy to be here.
Right, can you give us all an introduction to yourself? Who are you? Where in your academic journey are you? And which areas of paleontology are you interested in?
So I'm a PhD student at Virginia Tech, and here I'm predominantly working on, and I'm most interested in, late Triassic archosaurs. So archosaurs being the group that contains both crocodiles and birds today, and includes a whole host of fun critters back in the past, with a especially big diversity of Pseudosuchians, which is the group that I'm most focused on, I would say, back in the late Triassic, before most of them, apart from crocodilomorphs, got wiped out at the end Triassic.
Yeah, well, I think we've spoken a bit about that with Tom Stubbs before. I think I remember that. Loads of strange crocodile-y, but not crocodile things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. There's loads of things. There's a bunch of terrestrial Pseudosuchians at this time, including probably my favourite ones, which are the aetosaurs, which I have a project on currently looking at their teeth. And these are, well, big old to smallish, heavily armoured reptiles. They've got little snub noses, very, very cute. and they were predominantly thought to be herbivorous.
Ah, yes, I do remember these now. I can picture one, I think. So why then decide to go to this conference about dinosaurs?
Well, a large part of it is that I'm from the UK, as you can probably hear. And I was in the area anyway. My parents live near London. I have a friend who's in London who I could stay with. But also it just sounded like a lot of fun. And this conference is celebrating 200 years of dinosaur paleontology, which is not going to come around again. It's a one-time thing. So I really wanted to go and see it and experience this conference, because chances are I'm probably not going to see the 300th anniversary.
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. So this is your first PaleoCast assignment. How did you find it? It's a bit different doing, say, an interview to doing all of these interviews at a conference. I mean, you ended up doing like 10 or something.
Yeah, it was definitely nerve-wracking. Getting the first one done was the hardest, for sure. Being brave enough to go up to someone, shout out to Steve Brasate for being my first victim and being very, very nice about it. And once that was out of the way, it wasn't too bad. But yeah, I was definitely a bit nervous. It was also tricky to convince people to go into slightly quieter areas away from the main conference floor, which I'm sure you'll hear in some of the interviews. But there we go.
And the interviews didn't detract from your conference experience. You were still able to enjoy it for what it was. I know a lot of the time, like when I've been to, say, like SVP or something, I don't even get to listen to half the talks because I'm so busy focusing on who I'm going to talk to next and what I should talk to them about. You did get to enjoy it still, yeah?
Oh, yeah, for sure. It was it's a lot smaller than SVP, so there weren't multiple sessions going on at once. It was just a one session broken up throughout the day, which was good because it meant that everyone was in the room all times. So it was only during breaks that I actually could interview people, which meant that I got to be present for everything during the conference. Although I was frantically typing notes throughout the entire time of people who I might want to interview and coming up with questions. But yeah, no, I don't think it detracted at all. If anything, it was probably enhanced it a bit because I got to talk to more people than I would have been brave enough to talk to usually about their really cool research.
Well, you did manage to get some fantastic interviews and insights from the delegates. What is going to be next, though? What would your first, like, actual proper interview? What kind of thing are you feeling for that?
Oof, I don't know about first. There's definitely a couple of papers that I'm anticipating are almost certainly going to be released within the next year that I would definitely like to interview the authors of. The issue is I can't really say what they're going to be because they're not published yet. Things to do with dinosaurs mostly, a couple of Sudasukian bits and pieces, looking at biomechanics, new species, ontogeny, so growth. That's the sort of the topics of these things without going into really any detail whatsoever.
Oh, that's exciting though, yeah.
Yeah. I'm also kind of interested in maybe interviewing several people for maybe an episode on disability in the field in particular. Because, I mean, that's something that's kind of close to home for me. And I think it'll be very interesting. I think it's not often talked about how that impacts people actually going out into the field. So I think that'd be really interesting.
Yeah, I don't think we've ever spoken about it on Paleocast, so definitely. So anyway, we've got this brilliant episode for you to enjoy. And as always, we've got Emily's pictures, which as always, we've got Emily's pictures.
Always. I'm the only one who's ever taken pictures for Paleocast. So I've also got some photos to accompany the episode that will be on our website. There's a few selfies, a few awkward selfies, but the rest are pretty cool with some nice dinosaurs and speakers and things. But also please help us with visibility on social media with likes, shares and reviews. And I hope you enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome to Paleocast. I'm Emily Keeble, and at the beginning of the year, I was in London for the Natural History Museum's 200 Years of Dinosaurs, New Perspectives on an Ancient World conference. It was a bit of a whirlwind, being only 2 days long and packed with 34 fantastic talks from researchers all over the world. There was a great selection covering a wide range of topics, and I was lucky enough to conduct a number of mini interviews in between sessions that we'll be diving into in a moment. Sessions took place in the museum's Flett Theatre, where the conference was kicked off by a public lecture by Professor Steve Brasato. The next morning, the chairman of the museum and curator of dinosaurs, Professor Paul Barrett, introduced the day. But I think the most exciting moment of the first morning was the unveiling of a glass case on the stage, which contained the absolutely iconic jaw of Megalosaurus, which we'll hear a bit more about later from Paul. This fossil is usually kept under lock and key in the collections of the Oxford University Museum of Natural History, though there is a replica on display in the museum. So it was a real privilege to get to see the specimen up close. And I got an absolutely terrible selfie with it, so that was fun. So without much more ado, it is my pleasure to introduce the interviewees, who were very kind to give me their time and to chat conference, research, and the past and future of dinosaur paleontology with me. Professor Steve Brasato started off the entire conference the day before the main event with a talk based around his book, The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs, which I would recommend. Steve is also well known as the consultant on the final Jurassic World film and has just announced that he will be involved in the next instalment. So I'm here with Dr. Steve Brasato, who works at the University of Edinburgh. And Steve, first of all, I just wanted to ask how you're enjoying the conference.
Well, thanks, Emily. It's been a lot of fun. It's been a couple of days of just a lot of really interesting talks, a lot of interesting people, a lot of the leading dinosaur researchers from around the world are here. I mean, there's people from I don't even know how many countries, but China, Argentina, really across the world. And that's just some of the keynotes. And then there's a lot of young scientists, too. So I think it's a very fitting way to commemorate these two centuries since Buckland first named Megalosaurus, and amazing to see all the new research that's happening now.
Fantastic. In your book, The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs.
Thanks for the plug.
And also your public lecture. You chronicled the evolutionary history of dinosaurs, which I believe would make you an excellent person to tell us about what you consider, it's a massive question, sorry, some of the most important discoveries of the last 200 years.
Yeah. Well, it all starts with Buckland on that cold winter night in February of 1824 when he stood up and he unveiled Megalosaurus, and he was the first person to give a dinosaur a formal scientific name. I mean, of course, people have been encountering dinosaur bones for millennia, and there's Native Americans and indigenous people in South America, Central Asian tribes, all kinds of people found dinosaurs, but Buckland was the first one to put like a modern scientific name to one. And then over the next few decades, other people, largely in England, but also throughout Europe and then farther afield, found more fossils. And then by the early 1840s, that crystallized into this knowledge that there was a whole group of these ancient primeval large reptiles, which Owen gave the name dinosaur to. Since then, the American West opened up. So many famous dinosaurs in the 1870s and beyond from places like Colorado and Wyoming, Allosaurus and Stegosaurus and Brontosaurus and all of those. So that age of discovery was really important. T-Rex came a bit later in the early part of the 1900s, also from Western North America. And then, you know, into the 20th century, more people started to look for dinosaurs all over the world. Feathered dinosaurs were discovered in China by farmers first in the 1990s. Those have been the most important discoveries of my lifetime, these fossils that show us that, you know, not only that prove that birds evolved from dinosaurs, but show us how birds evolved from dinosaurs. And then today, there's people finding more dinosaurs than ever before. There's, you know, 50 new species or so every year that are being found, largely by young people, younger paleontologists all over the world as the field is diversifying.
Excellent. And just finally, very quickly, have you seen any talks that you've particularly liked, or have you got any that you're really looking forward to today?
There's a lot of things here that have been really neat. I guess the best part for me here is just meeting a lot of younger researchers who I haven't met before, just because of the whole way the world has been over the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
You know, there haven't been so many conferences, and the conferences there have been, you know, not everybody goes to all of them. So there's a whole bunch of young people that are doing exciting research that I've read their papers, and I kind of know their names, and I wanted to meet them. There's just a really neat talk about Bergman's rule, this idea that animals are larger at higher latitudes or in colder places. And it was a young student who gave that talk also on behalf of one of his co-authors who's still a master's student. And it's really fascinating. They use, you know, huge data set to look at this. And they're arguing that there is no rule, this long-standing ecological rule. They're using fossils to test that. And that's student work. And that sort of thing is really exciting.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Dr. Nizar Ibrahim is a senior lecturer at the University of Portsmouth, best known for his work on the ChemChem group, where Spinosaurus can be found. His keynote talk was on African dinosaurs, and it was fascinating to learn about the history of paleontology in this relatively underexplored continent.
OK. I'm here with Dr. Nizar Ibrahim from the University of Portsmouth, and I wanted to ask you, obviously, as Dr. Spinosaurus himself, I have to ask about it. It's a very hot topic in paleontology. It's undergone a lot of changes since its discovery. Are we likely to see any more changes as we enter the next 100 years of dinosaur paleontology? Or do you think we have a pretty idea of, at the very least, what its appearance was?
Well, it's working on Spinosaurus is a little overwhelming at times because it does generate a lot of interest, to put it mildly. And sometimes you do kind of wish you had worked on a bivalve instead. But if you work on a large predatory dinosaur, you know, that obviously generates a lot of interest, not just within academic circles, but, you know, there are a lot of enthusiasts and, dinosaur fans, Jurassic Park fans. Everyone is kind of interested in Spinosaurus. Now, yeah, Spinosaurus has undergone some changes, but the thing is, it's not really unusual to see that in dinosaur paleontology. I mean, you know, we're here to celebrate the naming of Megalosaurus. Just look at the early reconstructions of Megalosaurus and look at how much that dinosaur has changed. Look at early reconstructions of Stegosaurus, you know, and the arrangement of the plates and all sorts of other things. Iguanodon, right? I mean, all dinosaurs have gone through this process. With Spinosaurus, it just happens to happen now, rather than, you know, decades ago, because, you know, we just had no good material. Now we have one skeleton. And of course, as we're digging up more bones of this skeleton, you know, we're going to refine our models. You know, that's how science works. And so, yes, there will be some some more, you know, updates, you know, and changes. But I think we're getting pretty close to a good basic understanding of the anatomy and ecology of Spinosaurus.
Yeah, the ecology is the one that's properly debated at the moment, I think, really. you spoke a bit about that in your talk, but you also spoke about repatriation of fossils, particularly to Africa from Europe, and mentioned that it can be a complicated process. So what issues are common when trying to repatriate fossils or investigating repatriation?
Well, sometimes the infrastructure just isn't there, So you might repatriate fossils to country X, and the fossils will just be put in a storage facility somewhere, and they will crumble to pieces. It's happened, right? I've seen it with my own eyes. And so I think, you know, we obviously care about these dinosaur skeletons, about the fossils. So what you really need to do is thorough, long-term infrastructure and capacity building. And that's hard. You know, you have to train young scientists, essentially the next generation of guardians for these ancient treasures. And that's a lot more challenging than people realize. Some people think like, oh, you just ship things back and that's it, you know, end of the story. It is quite difficult. And so when you're working in paleontology, it's, again, a little frustrating sometimes because a lot of the debate is oversimplified, right, when it comes to repatriation of specimens and so on. So, you know, as someone who's actually done this over several years, yes, there's issues like corruption, theft in some cases, sale of fossils from collections. But we've overcome those challenges, at least in Morocco, and we've established some really awesome collections.
Fantastic. And very quickly, because I think we need to go back into the next session, are there other locations in Africa or other underexplored areas of the world for paleontology that you would really like to visit and investigate?
Yes, in fact, there are several on my list right now. I'm going to visit several countries in Africa. I don't want to reveal too much, but we have some really, really big plans. And one really cool part of this large-scale project I'm working on at the moment is that we're also going to bring African scientists from, say, Morocco, and we'll have them look at outcrops in other parts of Africa. So we'll have a real exchange of expertise and ideas.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Sure. My pleasure.
Simba Srivastav is an undergraduate at Virginia Tech whose current project, in between all his regular university courses, focuses on a dinosaur from the famous Coelophysis quarry, similar to another dinosaur found in Ghost Ranch, New Mexico, Tawa.
I'm here with Simba Srivastav from Virginia Tech, and he is an undergraduate there. But you presented, as far as I'm aware, you're the only undergrad who has presented this conference, which is pretty cool. How does that feel?
Thank you very much. It's a great, great honor. A lot of these people are presenting work that they've been doing at like slightly higher levels. We have people who are like PhD students or like postdocs, and then the keynotes are all being given by people who are way ahead in their field. They have a great grasp of it. They have these really nice long talks. So it's cool to see like how the progression kind of goes of like mastery over your topic and over the methodologies and just presenting. I mean, I felt so nervous. And I've been getting to see people present super, super well. And it's great to have like a goal to go towards from where I am. But it's a great honor they would select me and, you know, more based on just the merit of my research than my experience or lack thereof.
I thought you did an excellent presentation, actually.
Oh, thank you very much, Emily. It means a lot.
Yeah. So your research is focused around a tower-like dinosaur that we have. We're working on at Virginia Tech. What sort of things can this dinosaur tell us?
Yeah, so the Tawa and its closest relatives seem to die off maybe like 10 million years, 10 to 12 million years before the end of the Triassic. But this is a Tawa-like dinosaur from one of the latest Triassic sites, the Coelophysis Quarry, which is a renowned site, very well sampled. And now that we know that there isn't really, at least at this area, Ghost Ranch, where Tawa was first discovered, we know that there isn't really a cap on how far this lineage goes, or at least there isn't the one that there appeared to be, and it could extend all the way up to the end Triassic. And so here's a lineage that maintains some of the like traits, the morphological traits of some of the earliest theropods or whatever herosaurids are, and takes them all the way to the end of the Triassic. And then they seem to die out maybe then, which also means that at the end of the Triassic, you're not just seeing like dinosaurs walk through while a bunch of Pseudozoicians die. You're seeing within Dinosauria, within even Theropoda, clades that have been well established for 20, 30 million years suddenly dying off. So it was a pretty big impact on Dinosauria as well.
That's awesome. And just briefly, what has been the highlight? We're nearly at the end of the conference now. What has been your highlight so far?
Oh,
it could
boy.
Be a talk or meeting someone, anything.
Oh, man. Yeah, I got to, we had a really cool banquet in the museum in Fossil Way, I believe it's called.
Yeah.
Really nice, you know, Indian food. And I got to sat next to someone who I never talked to before, Zagorz Niedzwiedzki. I don't know how to say his name, he's Polish, but I just like talked to him for the whole however long it was, and I learned so much. And that was, I think, like, that's something I'm really going to cherish. I mean, the presentation is kind of a blur in my mind. I think it's great to have that weight lifted off my shoulders. But that is something that I'll really, really carry, just meeting people and how nice everyone is and how friendly the audience has been. That really helped me be more confident. And yeah, so it's generally like meeting the people at conferences is always what really gets me. That's awesome.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Grzegorz Niedzwiedzki is a researcher at Uppsala University, and his talk introduced us to early Jurassic dinosaur faunas in the Holy Cross Mountains of Poland.
I'm here with Grzegorz Niedzwiedzki. Was that all right?
Yes.
Good. who gave a really cool talk about dinosaurs and new fossil finds in Poland. And we've been talking a lot about body fossils in this conference, the actual bones of dinosaurs, but some of your most significant finds in Poland have been footprints and trackways. So what can these ichnofossils tell us that bones can't?
Yes, it was in 2021, we found new locality in Poland. It's really funny because it's just 2 hours of drive from Warsaw, so not so far from capital of the country. And this is one of the most interesting locality with dinosaur fossils in Poland, and I think in Central Europe. We found there more than 5,000 of dinosaur footprints now, and every week we have even more footprints from this locality because it's sort of, you know, mega track site. When you have like a massive record of dinosaur footprints. So why dinosaur footprints are so interesting for us? It's locality from early Jurassic. And yeah, it's really interesting time in the evolution of dinosaurs because there's sort of like a first like a evolutionary radiation of dinosaurs during this time. And we don't know so much about this early post-extinction, post-Triassic dinosaur fauna. There's not so much sites around the world when we have, you know, bones from this time interval. So any finds from basal Jurassic are super important. And of course, in this locality, we have huge surfaces completely covered by footprints. We have trackways which are 10 meters long, so there's a lot of paleobiological and paleoecological information hidden there in this trace fossil record.
Yeah, that's awesome because you've got the long trackways. That will help a lot with figuring more things out than just a sole footprint.
The longest trackway, if I remember, it's like 15 steps.
So oh, that's cool.
Yeah,
nice.
That's cool. And it's ornithischian dinosaur.
Oh,
quadrupedal.
That's really cool. We've just mentioned ornithischian, but one of the slides on your talk showed there was a big abundance of theropod footprints.
Yes, but yeah, of course, theropod dinosaurs are really characteristic. You have this really elongated middle toe and of course claws. There's always record trace after big claw on all digits, and yeah, that's been. It's not a big surprise to see theropod dinosaur footprints in early Jurassic site, but in this locality, there is something funny with this theropod tracks. I think we have something what is completely new also for early Jurassic. Some of these footprints are strange, with slightly elongated claw impression on outer digits. This is definitely something new. And even more, some of these theropod tracks are so well preserved that, you know, we have some information about the, you know, entanglement, like impressions after scales. And there is also a few traces done by sitting theropods.
Oh, that's cool.
So we have this belly impression, we have this metatarsal parts. Yeah, it's really interesting. But we still don't understand what is preserved in all of these footprints, because it's a fresh discovery. So everything is under study now, but I'm sure there will be more really interesting information about also early Jurassic theropods based on this ichnological material.
Yeah. Is this sort of is it an overabundance of theropods that we see, and is this like to be what we're actually seeing?
But my simple calculations is that the ratio between ornithischian and theropod footprints is like 80-20.
Wow!
So there is a lot of ornithischian tracks there, and there is a high diversity of these ornithischian tracks. But what is really surprising, it's the fact that there is no sauropodomorph footprints.
Oh, okay.
We have few thousands of footprints from several layers from the same area. No sauropodomorphs.
Wow. At all.
This is weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because in other sites in the same region, slightly younger or slightly older, we have records of sauropodomorphs. Mm. So, yeah, there is something funny here.
Yeah. Just this is more just for me, to be honest. You mentioned some interesting osteoderms in your talk, so bone armor at your main site. Do you know, or have you got any hypotheses for what those might be from?
Yeah, this is fun. When we found first osteoderms in this locality, and of course it was clear for us that, okay, we are in this basal Mesozoic Jurassic, I was super excited because I was, oh yeah, maybe we have, you know, the youngest record of Pseudosuchians in the fossil records, maybe something survived from Triassic to the early Jurassic.
I would
to the
Septangian,
like something like a, you know, Etosaurid or maybe sort of, you know, a Rhizuchian. But after, yeah, additional finds. We have also, of course, other bone elements from this locality. Yeah, it's more and more clear for us that, yeah, this is record of dinosaurs. So we have, so this is, yeah, I'm sure, pteriform stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, thariophans.
Yeah. Sorry for pronunciation. All
no,
these
no, it's great. Anyway,
so. But I have such a feeling that, yeah, this is record of ornithischian dinosaurs. Yeah.
And just finally, we are nearly at the end of the conference. What are your highlights? Are there any talks that you especially liked at all? Or?
Yeah, all presentations here are really amazing. Of course, I'm working mainly with trace fossils. There was not so much about trace fossils. Peter Falkingham's presentation was really interesting, showing what is possible to do based on, you know, trace fossil record, and that was also from visual point of view really cool. You know, like it was all of these animations.
Yeah.
Like a show, you know, like a proper show.
Yeah, it was really cool seeing the animation of the foot motion determined from the trace fossils.
But of course, I'm working with Triassic fossils, so yeah, all of these Triassic stories were especially interesting for me.
Yeah, there's been a good number of Triassic talks,
yes,
I think.
Yes, like origin of dinosaurs.
Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for talking to
thank
me.
Thank you.
Dr. Sterling Nesbitt is actually my advisor here at Virginia Tech, most known for his work on archosaurs, especially those of the Triassic. This was reflected in his keynote talk on the earliest evolution of dinosaurs in the chaotic Triassic world.
I'm talking to Dr. Sterling Nesbitt from Virginia Tech. And your talk revolved around the sort of early relationships of dinosaurs and basically what a mess they are. What could help untangle this, and can you explain a little bit about it?
I always thought we would find more fossils and things would become clearer, but it's actually the opposite. As we find more dinosaurs and close relatives, we're finding more and more homoplasia, convergent characters and ecologies in all these animals, which I find exciting because it shows that they were doing many things again and again. They were evolving the same kind of ecologies. You get shifts for getting longer limbs, different kinds of stances. They were becoming herbivores, maybe insectivores, and so on and so on. Of course, this all wrecks what we think about our traditional relationships, but I still think it's an exciting time, and I still think we can get those relationships with a careful look at some of these new species. There's been an avalanche of new information that I don't think we've sorted through yet, and that's only going to be supplemented with more finds over the next 10, 20, 30 years.
Oh, I look forward to it. And one of the very messy parts of this tree is the issue with psilosaurids. So if Psilosaurids, as is one hypothesis, turn out to be Ornithischians proper, you have said that diagnostic characters for Dinosauria will basically no longer be valid. Would we just need to establish an entirely new set of characters, and how would we go about doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. All of our traditional dinosaur diagnostic characters, I think, would be invalid. I don't know what those other characters would be, but our classic character of having an open acetabulum would have evolved in more than one lineage within dinosaurs. We know that there are parallel evolutions of some of these character states, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but we would have to find a new set of diagnostic characters for Dinosauria, which right now would probably be similar to what we call dinosaur forms.
Cool. And as we've been looking back at the last 200 years of paleontology, where in the world do you think that we should be looking for new specimens that might get us out of the phylogenetic mud in the next 200 years?
Oh, we should just go back to the same places and look again and again and again and dig bigger holes sometimes.
Sounds good. And finally, we're at the end of the conference now. Have you got any highlights or favorite talks that you've seen?
The talks have just been fantastic and really highlight how far we've come, not just in 200 years, but I would say the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And there are so many new analyses, there's so many new specimens, there's people collecting primary data, and they have new ways to look at that primary data again and again, which I think is really exciting because we are finally getting some statistical power to really vet some long-held ideas, and I just think that's going to get better and better as we go forward.
No longer stamp collecting.
There is always a part of that, right? There is always going to be go out, find specimens. Yeah. Even if you don't know what they are, you put them in museums, and someone will figure out what they are. And I think that is probably the most important part, but now there are just so many techniques we can extract more and more information from these incredible animals.
Excellent. Thank you.
Professor Paul Barrett and Dr. Susie Maidment are the dinosaur curators at the London Natural History Museum and conceived and organised the conference with the help of their team. Both focused their research on different questions primarily around the herbivorous dinosaurs, namely the Ornithischians and sauropodomorphs, and I guess the occasional theropod, with Susie in particular being an expert on stegosaurs.
I'm here with Professor Paul Barrett, who works at the London Natural History Museum as curator of dinosaurs, and is obviously one of the organisers of this event. And of course, we are celebrating 200 years of dinosaurs with this conference. But can you tell us a little about that very early history of paleontology and dinosaur research?
Sure. So it was very much by accident. So usually quarrymen looking for building stones, finding these strange objects buried within the earth. And I'm sure dinosaur fossils have been found for millennia, but often just mistaken for natural curiosities or the bones of ancestral kind of mythological features, creatures, things like this. So it was, but the key thing was that at this time, people were starting to think more scientifically about what these objects might be, about the age of the Earth in general, about the variety of life, because people were also exploring the globe and specimens were coming back from far-flung features of the world to Europe, where they were being studied and categorized for the first time, and the first discoveries of dinosaurs are also being found in this kind of intellectual environment. So people are curious about what these objects were, how they were formed, and to start with, they were probably just collected as curiosities. But in the 19th century, they started to be studied more systematically compared with living animals, people thinking about their place within the strata of the earth and how old they might be, and then suddenly realizing that there were all these animals that were very unlike those alive today, at least the ones they knew about, and that these animals gave a window into a past world that was very, very different from the ones we know about. And to start with, for most of the first few decades of working on dinosaurs in particular, we really just had scraps, bits and pieces, no complete skeletons, and we had to wait some time until the first even partial skeletons of dinosaurs started to be found in the rocks of southern England and northern Europe that showed how these earlier finds all finally started to come together and what the animals really looked like, rather than the guesswork that had been happening up till then.
Yeah, of course, the Crystal Palace dinosaurs are famously an early depiction, looking rather squat and lizard-like, very different to what we see them as today. A lot of this early history happened in the UK. Would you say that it's really important that we had this celebration here and in the NHM in particular?
It was an excuse to get a large number of dinosaur people in one place at one time. So there are a lot of scientific conferences around the world, but there are very few that are specifically on dinosaurs. So having a really nice anniversary to tie a gathering of dinosaur specialists together seemed like a really good idea. And we have some of the original of those first dinosaurs here in our collections. So we have a very strong historical link with the group, not least because the founder of the Natural History Museum was Sir Richard Owen, who actually coined the word dinosaur. So we've always felt a little bit like the spiritual home, if you like, of the dinosaur. So it seemed very appropriate that we might host a conference like that.
Excellent. And speaking of those early dinosaurs, those first three, you had quite a surprise for the attendees at the on the first day of the conference. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Oh, we were very lucky, actually. Our colleagues in Oxford, who wanted to attend the meeting, and she said, you know what, it'd be really nice if we're going to mark the 200th anniversary naming of Megalosaurus. Why don't we bring one of the original specimens of Megalosaurus from down with us? Because Megalosaurus actually lives in Oxford Museum, so all of those specimens are there, and they very kindly brought down the type jaw of Megalosaurus just to display for one day, just as a special treat behind the scenes for the conference delegates. So we had a direct link to that first announcement of a dinosaur name. The other two dinosaurs, Hylaeosaurus and Iguanodon, live in our own collections, but Megalosaurus wins the crown for being the one that was first named.
Yeah, there was a very satisfying ooh that went through the audience, getting to see such an iconic fossil. I mean, if you like dinosaurs in any capacity, past, I don't know, being like a child, probably even with a child, you will have seen that iconic jaw. So it was exciting to see it. Was there any logistical difficulties in getting it here?
It's actually quite small, so not at all. Luckily, Emma and Duncan from Oxford carefully packed it up. They brought it down in one of their museum vehicles, so they brought it in before the conference started so we could safely get it tucked in its case and hidden under a cloth before anybody saw it. And then it was spirited back to Oxford immediately afterwards and safely tucked back in their stores that evening.
Brilliant. As I said, you were, of course, one of the organisers of the conference. When was this idea conceived, and have there been any interesting things that happened or you discovered during the planning?
We actually thought we wanted to commemorate this anniversary some time ago, so we had in mind some kind of event for this year. Going back several years now, actually, we've been thinking about what we might do. But the idea for an actual conference, I think, came around something 2 or 3 years ago, and we were throwing this idea around. And it wasn't really, there was no real motivation for it other than to commemorate the anniversary and to use it as a celebration, really, of what dinosaur science is like now, and to try and bring lots of different colleagues from lots of different career stages and from all over the world into one place just to basically swap the latest information and network with each other and catch up a bit, and at the same time have a little bit of a party to think about Buckland's work all those years ago and how we're going, where we've got to now, and also to a little bit of future thinking about where we might be going in the future for the next 200
years.
Yes,
well, that was exactly what I wanted to ask next. Where do you see paleontology going? Perhaps not in the next 200, that's quite far away, but in the next good few years?
It's actually really difficult to tell. I mean, I've been professionally a dinosaur scientist now for about 25 years. And in the length of my career, I've seen huge changes already in that relatively short period compared with 200 years. So when I was doing my PhD, that's when feathered dinosaurs were first discovered. During my PhD also, when people used to show a CT reconstruction in a talk, the room would gasp with amazement, especially if that CT reconstruction span or did anything like that. These days, those kinds of reconstructions are standard.
Yeah, no,
in many
I do
talks.
That every day.
And many people just thought, oh, it's another CT reconstruction, whereas it was almost like magic when I was doing my PhD. And nowadays, we see in particular a lot of new geochemical techniques coming along that are giving a lot of insights into even things potentially like dinosaur thermal biology or the colour of dinosaur eggs. And we're also starting to see a lot of things that we used to talk about in a much more speculative, almost arm-waving way, actually now getting some real mathematical, statistical, quantitative rigor in a way that simply didn't exist again when I started my PhD. So I did my PhD on the functional morphology of dinosaur feeding. I spent a lot of time looking at teeth and jaws. I certainly wasn't doing the kinds of levels of analytical detail we'd now do with a finite element analysis of a skull, these types of things. So it's in those 20 years we've seen paleontology move into this very quantified, testable set of hypotheses. And I only see that becoming more rigorous in future. There's always an underlying current of new actual discovery of new primary data, new specimens coming out of the ground, reinterpretations of specimens in museums. But it's really stunning to see the new techniques that people are developing and bringing, borrowing techniques from ecology, borrowing techniques from engineering. And I think all of these things will just continue. And I find it quite difficult to keep up with some of the techniques and some of the methods now. I dread to think what it would be like that by the time I retire. I think I will feel completely stupid by the time I retire.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that's probably going to be a case for a lot of us. but I'm looking forward to it, looking forward to seeing what happens. Just one more question, the most important question. I must ask about the ongoing investigation. Has the little green sauropod been returned from this escapade away from the banquet?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure what happened to the little green sauropod. I'm sure it's on an adventure somewhere. I don't know if it's come back to meet its other equally brightly coloured dinosaurian chums. I haven't caught up to find out. But if it's the one thing that goes missing from this conference, I can live with that.
Excellent. Thank you so much for giving me your time, and congratulations on a really great conference.
Thank you very much.
I'm here with Dr. Susie Mainment, who is curator of dinosaurs at the London Natural History Museum and one of the organisers of the 200 Years of Dinosaurs conference. And she has very kindly agreed to meet me after the fact. Obviously, it was a very, very busy period for you. How did that go, the conference? How do you felt it went overall?
Well, I think the conference was really, really a huge success. I feel really happy with the way it went. It was very, very busy for me. I barely felt like I had time to breathe or to get a cup of tea or to have a break or anything. But it was, I think we had a really good balance of talks. I think we had some fantastic speakers, and it was really great to see, 150 dinosaur researchers from all around the world coming together. So yeah, great conference.
I thought so too. I really, really enjoyed it. And of course, the conference was celebrating 200 years of dinosaur research. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of the early dinosaur research that we were celebrating?
Yeah, so we were celebrating 200 years since the naming of Megalosaurus, which is a meat-eating dinosaur that lived in the Middle Jurassic period in what is now Oxfordshire. And this dinosaur was named by a guy called William Buckland, who was a reverend and a naturalist. He was sort of a bit of a polymath, really. He knew loads and loads about all different things and had really spent his career trying to go out there and prove the Bible, I guess, all the things that were said in the Bible were true. He didn't manage that, but on the way he did find quite a lot of interesting things. And among those was fossils of this meat-eating dinosaur, Megalosaurus. And we were very lucky at the conference that the guys from the Oxford University Museum of Natural History brought down those original, Buckland's original bones. Now, of course, at the time, the word dinosaur hadn't been coined yet. That wasn't coined until 1842 by Richard Owen. So, Buckland didn't describe Megalosaurus as a dinosaur at the time. He just described it as, a great big extinct thing, extinct reptile. But yeah, it was officially the first dinosaur that was named.
That's pretty fascinating. I didn't know that about Buckland's original mission.
I think that's right. Like, I feel like that's right. I'm going to have to fact check myself.
It's all right. We'll cut it if it's not. Yeah. So what do you think it was that made the UK such a hotbed for the earliest sort of formal research into geology and dinosaur paleontology in particular?
Well, I think in the UK and probably across Europe, the Victorian era, it was really an era of innovation in lots of ways. And, in terms of things like medicine, but also in terms of the natural sciences. And there was all these sort of landed gentry who were at their leisure because they were funded by their large estates, who were able to sort of go out and wander around. And actually, a lot of the early naturalists were in the Church of England, and they gave talks, and you know, some of them became professors at universities. And of course, Gideon Mantell, who lived right here where I am right now, in the same town that I live in, was he was a doctor. But these people were just, you know, they were very interested in the natural world, and I guess answering questions about the natural world. And you know, it's interesting why were they described and found and recognised for what they were here in the UK before anywhere else? You know, I don't really know what the answer to that question is. And there were many places that were hot on the heels of the UK. I mean, you know, dinosaurs were discovered very shortly afterwards in the States, in, of course, in Belgium, the famous Iguanodon discoveries. So, you know, I think it was probably just chance, largely. But I do think that there was a sort of a bit of an era of innovation at the time as well, and excitement about the natural world and making discoveries.
Yeah, and it would be very nice to have those huge sums of money and just leisurely be able to do what we want to do today.
Absolutely. Wouldn't we all like to be retired and just around the countryside looking at stuff?
That'd be great. What do you think those early researchers would think of how far paleontology has come today?
I mean, I think, you know, it would just absolutely blow their minds, just the technology that we have to apply to fossils today. You know, I think about this quite a lot, and it's one of the things that we have, you know, what the importance of having museum collections is, that some of our specimens have been in the collections at the Natural History Museum for, you know, 150 years or more. And, you know, the people that found them would never have thought of the things that we can do with them now, like put them in a CT scanner or take them to a particle accelerator. You know, those things just didn't exist. And so I think it's always worth looking back at that and thinking, what would these people have thought? Because in 150 years from now, we have no idea what techniques and technologies might be out there that might give us entirely new insights into these specimens in our collection. So I think it really underscores the importance of museum collections and keeping specimens, you know, for future generations and for future discoveries.
Yeah, even the specimens I worked on for my master's research were collected, some of them as far back as the early 60s. So those being in the museum collection and not having been looked at enabled like me to describe a new species of Rhynchocephalian, like a Tuatara type animal.
Well, and the interesting thing about the stuff that you worked on in your master's as well is that there's so much of that material, and yeah, that we have so much of it that hasn't been looked at and hasn't even...
I think there was a paper published this week, actually, looking at it.
There was. I've just been talking about it. And, you know, this material, we still have huge, huge amounts of matrix full of fossils that has never been broken down. So, you know, there's discoveries just waiting for a keen person to come along and make them, really.
Yeah, that's awesome. And sort of switching, looking more at the organisation side, you, of course, organised the conference. When was the idea sort of conceived for that? And have there been any interesting things that happened or challenges in the length of the planning?
The idea was Paul's originally. He, a few years ago, he's been saying it for a few years now, and he was saying, you know, we really need, as an institution, to celebrate this incredible anniversary. And do something. And he came up with this idea of a conference. And we realised quite quickly, and especially after I ran another conference, the Symposium of Vertebrate Paleontology and Comparative Anatomy last year, how difficult it is to run these big conferences and you know, how much support you need and how much sort of institutional buy-in you need, really. So we decided to get well ahead of the game, and we went to talk to the executive directors across the museum, and I presented in a meeting of them to try and get their buy-in and to try and get them excited about this anniversary. And they were really excited about it, and they thought that it was a great opportunity to do all sorts of things, not just, you know, welcome some of the top dinosaur researchers from all around the world, but, you know, also we had, of course, the public lecture by Steve. That was a great event. We had more than 300 people joining, both in person and online, for that event. So it was a really big event. We were able to make that freely available to our members. So, you know, we were able to really get their buy-in from a whole bunch of different points of view. And what that allowed us to do was to organise the conference with in a relatively relaxed way. And Our events team then took on the leadership of actually doing things like sorting the ticketing out and sorting the comms out. And that just made it completely stress-free for us. So it was really straightforward. And also, you know, we invited 8 keynote speakers and all of them said yes. So we didn't have to kind of, you know, think about somebody else or where we're going to go with that or change our plans. And we put out our call for abstracts and we had 26 slots for talks and we had about 52 abstracts submitted. So we had a huge number of people who wanted to present at this conference. So, you know, we were really able to go through and, you know, what we really wanted was to have some really broad talks that would be a very wide general interest to people and also kind of display a variety of techniques and methods that people are using across our discipline, you know, everything from kind of quantitative methods for looking at diversity to, you know, faunas from new places. And we really wanted to, you know, cover all of that. And we were really lucky because the abstracts that we got were all so amazing that, you know, we were having to reject abstracts that were absolutely brilliant. And, you know, it was really hard to choose them. But I think what we ended up with was a really nice balanced program. So, no, you know, everything went to plan, and I have to give a massive shout out to Katie Payne and the NHM's events team because they really made it possible, and it was just, you know, very, very smooth and easy for Paul and I. So yeah, it was great.
Yeah, I did try to talk to Katie afterwards, but she looked very tired, so I thought maybe not.
Yeah, I think she's gone to lie down for a week.
Yes, I think that's what she said. What were your favourite parts in that organisation?
Oh, well, in the run-up to the meeting?
Yeah.
Well, I think getting the abstracts in and being able to look through all the abstracts and then sort of plot out the programme, I think that's a really interesting thing to do. I think it's amazing to see what everybody's doing and everybody's research and how they're, you know, yeah, just so many different techniques and so many different research groups. And actually, another thing that really struck me was that we had a whole range of people from, like, across different career stages, and we didn't plan it like that. Like, we didn't say, okay, we're only gonna, you know, we want to accept some abstracts from early career researchers, some from PhD students. We literally just read the abstracts and went, which are the ones that, you know, we think fulfill our aims of displaying this very broad diversity that our discipline has to offer in terms of subject area. And we ended up with, I think, our most junior speaker was an undergrad. From your institution, from Virginia Tech. And he absolutely smashed it.
He was fantastic.
Yeah, he really did. I was so impressed. I thought, gosh, you know, if I could have stood up as an undergraduate and done a talk like that, it was amazing. And then, you know, right the way through to really incredibly senior people in the field, so people like Matt LaManna, and of course, you know, our keynotes, we invited people like Xu Xing and Diego Powell. So it was, you know, really really delighted that we were able to do that. And that was a really fun part of it for me, was it was being able to sort of work on that program and fit all those bits together.
And for the actual conference itself, were there any big highlights there at all that you remember?
Oh, there were so many. I thoroughly enjoyed all of our keynotes talks, and, you know, actually I thoroughly enjoyed all of the talks. I didn't think there was any that were, you know, subpar. I thought they were all good. So it's very difficult to choose. I really, really enjoyed Nizar Ibrahim's talk on fossils from the Chemchem. I thought that was really interesting. I also really enjoy listening to Peter Falkingham talk about trackways.
I thought that one was brilliant.
He always does these brilliant, you know, the videos and amazing talks. I thoroughly enjoyed those. And of course, the dinner was just stunning. Did you make it to the dinner?
Yes, I did.
It was excellent. Yeah, it was such an incredible venue to eat dinner.
Yeah, I've been saying, like, I don't need to get married anymore because that was my dream reception venue, so I'm good.
Yeah. It was so fabulous. And again, you know, that was all organised by Katie and her team. So it was just great. And the food, I think it was the best conference food that I've ever eaten. So
it was really very good. And the ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs on the wall just elevated it even more.
Yeah. And I was really, I mean, another thing that really was a great addition to the conference was that we got to have pudding for the dinner in the Titanosaur exhibition, and of course have it open every morning for you guys to have a look around, which was great because originally the exhibition was actually going to have closed already by the time we ran the conference, and they extended it for a week and we were able to use it as a venue, really, which it's an incredible specimen. So that was great as well.
Yeah, I thought that was all fantastic too. There have been 200 years of academic dinosaur research. What do you expect or hope to see in the next 200, or possibly a little bit shorter? It might be a bit difficult to say what we're going to see in 200.
That's a difficult question, Emily. Yeah. I think that a thing that is that we're seeing increasingly, and we're just going to see more of, is the sort of looking at soft tissues and there's this increasing evidence that soft tissues and the breakdown products of soft tissues are actually able to be preserved over geologic timescales. And I think that's a really quite a new and quite a startling discovery. So we've got people looking at things like melanosomes in feathers and looking at colour. But people are moving beyond that. You know, we're seeing breakdown products of hemoglobin, we're seeing breakdown products of collagen, DNA, breakdown products of DNA. I think, you know, I never like to say that we're never going to know something. And I do wonder whether that there might be some DNA out there that's preserved geologic timescales. But I think that, you know, the advances that can be made with these sorts of soft tissues and these sorts of chemical breakdown products, chemical fossils, are going to really change our understanding, or at least, you know, very much enhance our understanding of things like metabolism and physiology, which we really do struggle to get to grips with at the moment.
Yeah, that'll be fantastic to see. I'm sure it will come to fruition, to be honest, looking at the way things are going. And is there anything that you would like to say potentially to the next generation of paleontologists who will make those advancements and take us into the next 200 years of paleontology?
Well, you know, I think that one of the great things about what we do, about academia in general, not just paleontology, is that really, we get to do things that we love, interesting things that we love to do anyway, that we probably do as a hobby, with people that we like, right? We get to choose who we work with. So it's incredibly flexible. You know, we get to choose what we do broadly. And I think that, that's something that we always need to remember, is that, you know, we kind of need to pursue things that interest us as well as things that, you know, sometimes you can get lost in this need to seek high impact papers or, you know, publish or perish and everything. But, you know, I think that the most important thing is to not lose sight of why we're all here in the first place. Do what you love, basically. I think that's my 5-year plan. doesn't always satisfy my bosses, that 5-year plan. That's how I like to think of it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. That is all the questions I had for you. And once again, thank you for talking to me after the meeting has finished.
No problem. Yeah. Sorry. Again, I couldn't do it. I was just like, when you saw me on Friday, I was like, oh my God, no. Oh, just
no, no, it's no. Okay. I could see. I was like, no, we'll do this later. Okay. Thank you so much.
No worries. Take care. Speak to you soon.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed this little foray into the world of dinosaur paleontology, and also what it sounds like to get 150 nerds in a room to talk about their favourite subject, also known as a conference.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Liz Martin-Silverstone, Tom Fletcher, Nick Lupshire, Emily Keeble, and Sophie Pollard. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, our listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider supporting us on Patreon, where you'll gain access to additional multimedia content, and thanks to everyone who's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. And follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.